Welcome to Rights for Women, a podcast all about celebrating women's voices and supporting women writers. I'm Pamela Cook, women's fiction author, writing teacher, mentor, and podcaster. Before beginning today's chat, I would like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the Dharawal people, the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is being recorded, along with the traditional owners of the land throughout Australia. And a quick reminder that there could be strong language and adult concepts discussed in this podcast, so please be aware of this if you have children around. Let's relax on the convo couch and chat to this week's guest. Hello, welcome to another episode of Rights for Women. It is Thursday, the 20th of June, as I'm recording this introduction, and this episode will actually be out tomorrow, which is Friday, the 21st of June. This is a fabulous chat between three debut authors. I wanted to pull together a few authors who I know have had recent releases and talk to them about their experience as debut authors. So there's so much in here for debut authors or people aspiring to publication, but also really interesting, I think, to listen to for more experienced authors, people who have had a few books out, and maybe to compare experiences. In this episode, we're going to be chatting to Helen Signey, Jill Valentine, and Maxine Fawcett. They've all had books out in the last few months. Three very different books, which I'm going to let the authors themselves tell you about, and that is coming up in today's episode. Not a whole lot of personal news for me, except to say that I've just come back from a fantastic retreat with my writers group, the Inkwell. I've spent 4 days in the beautiful Southern Highlands at the home of the lovely Penelope Janu and everybody else in the Inkwell, and it was just such a joy to spend time, 4 whole days, immersing ourselves in the world of writing. We talked about our own projects that we're working on, any difficulties that we're having with them, anything that we're finding that's working. We shared some ideas and some kind of video links and things for people that we've found some inspiration from. We talked about books that we're loving and what we're learning from them. We just did a whole lot of stuff to do with writing. We actually did some writing while we were there, some editing, and of course we ate, drank, and were very merry. If you are in a writer's group, I highly recommend trying to get away for a few days with your fellow writers and just being able to immerse yourself in that experience. If you're not in a writing group, my recommendation is that you definitely join one. I know that there are people out there who have had some not great experiences in writing groups, but I just find the support, the inspiration, and the motivation, as I've said many times on the podcast, I would not be doing it if it wasn't for that fabulous group of women. We'll now go on to the main episode of the podcast. Thank you to everybody who is listening, who has been sending me messages saying how much they're enjoying the episodes. It's really great to hear. If you do love the episodes, it would be great if you could give a rating or a review wherever you listen. It would be fantastic if you can share any of the episodes on social media and also recommending it to any of your friends. And don't forget, there's a great backlist of episodes there that you can listen to. And you can also join the Patreon community where you can get bonuses. Find out all about that on the website on the Patreon page. So thank you to all the Patreon supporters. And there'll be some more bonuses going out to you tomorrow. Without any further ado, let's get on with the episode with Jill Valentine, Helen Signey, and Maxine Fawcett talking about their experience as debut authors. Maxine, for Helen Signey and Jill Valentine, welcome to the Rights for Women Convo Couch.
Thank you. Thanks, Pam.
Morning.
Thank you.
Great to have you on, and congratulations to all three of you on your debut novels, which have all come out this year. And I'm really excited to talk to all three of you about your experiences, the writing of the novels, and how things have gone for you since publication. But can we start with each of you giving us perhaps your elevator pitch for your book or a short version of what the book is about? Jill, can we start with you?
Sure. So High Heels and Low Blows is a tale set in Sydney, present day, and it follows the lives of three women who, all very different, but are caught up in a world of chaos caused by the toxic, manipulative men in their lives. So the first main character is Bea Bloom, and she is the embodiment of a modern day leader. She is a female CEO of an investment bank, which is a rarity because there aren't many female CEOs. And she's kind, compassionate. And one day a new chairman arrives at the company and she works out very quickly that he had the in for her. The second character is Lucy Love, who is a binge drinking, depressed, stay at home mum who gave up her successful career as a TV presenter because of her 1950s husband. And to make matters worse for her, he's facing sexual harassment allegations and she's left going, is it true? And so we see her unravel a bit. And then the third character is Rosie Reed, who is a PR pro known as Sydney's fixer, because her job is to come in and basically clean up the mess of her misbehaving male clients. So whether it's a chairman that's been caught having sex with the receptionist, or whether it's a senior executive that's used the corporate credit card to pay for the strip clubs, she comes in and she's like kind of a fusher, if you like. And the looming question throughout is, will these toxic, manipulative men get their time?
I love that. Great rundown of the book there, Jill, because there's a lot to unpack in the story. And you've got, of course, three main characters, which I'm going to talk about when we get on to the writing process, which kudos to you, because doing that for your debut novel, I think is very brave. But we will come back to that. Thank you. Max, can you give us the rundown on Everything is Perfect?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Pam. Yeah, Everything is Perfect is about a woman called Cathy Flynn, and she lives in a beautiful beachside suburb, and she has a loving husband who travels a lot for work and two children, Ellie and Danny, and even an oodle dog. So from the outset, everything does look perfect. But she has started to, she's been in her mid-40s, and things aren't really seeming the same inside herself. She has just noticed the shift in everything that's going on. She had to give her job in free fall and to look after her son, who's struggling at school. And her UK, she finds out he's about to be really ill and in hospital. And everything, and her husband actually decides to travel a lot more for work and he's never there to help with anything. So at the beginning of the school term, and she drops her children off at school with all of these things going on and goes into the local cafe and sees the new dad that's just started at her children's primary school, who's a widower. And the moment she looks at him, she starts to think that maybe he could be the answer to her problem. And that's where the story begins. It's about middle age, you know, what it means to be a woman in your 40s when you just start to actually reassess things that happened in your past and your childhood and realize this is the moment to create kind of a new chapter for yourself. But yeah, Cathy has to go down a very slippery slope before that.
Yeah, I look so much in there that I think women can relate to regardless of age, but certainly women in that kind of 40 something age group. So
the beginning of the feeling invisible era.
Yeah, very much so.
But thanks, Pam. Thank you.
Thanks, Max. Helen, how about Mayor's Dance? Can you tell us about that? A little bit different. We're in a different time period and different location. So fill us in.
Sure. Thanks, Pam. So Mayor's Dance is historical fiction set in the Holocaust. So it's based very closely on the true story of a Holocaust survivor who used to live quite close to me in the northern beaches of Sydney. And I heard her story and just thought it had to be told. So Lucy, or Maya, as she's called in the book, was 15 when Hitler came into the Czech Republic where she lived. And she was a teenager. She absolutely loved to dance. And that's when she could feel free. But everything changed when the family were arrested and taken to a labor camp in East Poland. So it wasn't a death camp. They weren't killing people. They were making people work in the field. And there were hundreds and hundreds of these labor camps all over the place in Poland in those days to try and grow food to feed the Germans. And then when you got too weak to work, and then you were shipped off to Sobibor or wherever the nearest death camp was. So she was there with her mother and her stepfather, and still trying to be quite optimistic and everything. And made some friends with some other teenagers in the camp, and they decided to put on a show, which was incredibly quite common during the Holocaust. They loved to sing and dance and try and make themselves feel better. So she danced in this show, and one of the Polish guards was watching her from the other side of the square and just fell in love with her. So essentially, it's a love story between this 15-year-old and a guard, which in itself, I suppose, was a bit problematic. And then things get so difficult in the camp, it becomes very clear to them that nobody's supposed to survive, so he gets her out. So the story is of the escape, but it's told through a dual timeline of Maya in Sydney in the 1990s, telling her story to a young journalist who's a bit lost and she's just come out of a relationship and she's a bit depressed, and the old Maya imparts this incredible wisdom that most Holocaust survivors seem to have about how to live for every day and just appreciate the good in life and, live your life as if it's the last day. And then they go back to try and find him.
Oh, I got goosebumps listening to you telling that story. And as I've found in so many kind of Holocaust or war stories, anything set in that period, while there's so much kind of trauma and obviously it can be really hard to write and read, but just that sense of strength and resilience, it just always amazes me, and particularly so with this being, as many of them are, based on a true story. But I'm going to come back to that whole point about resilience, because I think that is something that is a feature of all of three of these books and the women that you write about. Can we stick with you for a little minute, Helen? I just want to ask each of you, going back in time now, because we're going to come back to talk about the novels a bit more, but going back, what was the moment that you first knew that you wanted to write a novel? And how did you then get from that point to publication? Helen, how did that happen for you?
So my kids are a little bit older, and the youngest one had started high school, and I was a bit bored. And I was at a conference in Canada, actually, and I was thinking, what am I going to do now for me? Should I do a master's and a PhD? I know, I'll write a novel. And it just started percolating. And I had heard the story of this Holocaust survivor a few years before and been absolutely fascinated with it, and always thought I might write it as a feature because I'm a journalist. And then I remember I was sitting on a boat. We were doing a day trip as part of the conference, and this character of Maya literally just came to me. It was a real sort of J.K. Rowling moment when she saw Harry Potter walking down the train. I just felt her. It was so bizarre. So obviously Maya is not the real Lucy. She's a fictional character, but I just imagined what it would be like to be a teenager running away from the Nazis. From that minute, I was, right, I've got to write a novel. And then I did a novel writing course for the Faber Writing Academy, and I don't think I ever would have got to the end of it had I not done that course. I had no idea where to start, what I was doing, how you structure a novel. That was really helpful. And when I started, my main end game was to just write a novel. I didn't even think I would ever get it published or send it off for publication. It's just something I wanted to do in midlife, just to show that I could do something. And then incredibly, when it was finished, I sent it off and it got picked up. So yeah, it's just been the most incredible experience that I never thought would happen. I would not have believed when I was sitting on that boat that I would one day be sitting here talking about my published novel.
It's amazing, isn't it? So you're published by Simon & Schuster, Helen. Did you send it just off to their slush pile, or what was the kind of mechanism that you sent it through?
As part of the Faber Writing Academy, they publish an anthology of a couple of thousand words for everybody's novel. So there was quite a lot of interest at that point, which was right in the middle or at the end of COVID. So I'd already had some interest and used that then in my emails to other agents. So now I got picked up by Curtis Brown. And it was just after The Happiest Man Alive, the Eddie Jacobs book. And I think everybody was looking for the next Holocaust novel. And it's a very crowded genre, obviously. But mine's a bit different because it's got the dual timelines. And a third of the novel is set in Sydney and is about the remembering and the going back. So, yeah, it was just a bit different. And I think that was the Holocaust novel that people were looking for. So once Curtis Brown had picked it up, and they actually suggested a big restructure. So I did a lot of rewriting before they sent it out. And once it got sent out, there was a lot of interest. Yeah, which was fantastic.
Fantastic. Amazing. How about you, Max? What's your story from when you first knew you wanted to write to getting that contract?
Yeah, well, I heard you interview a fantasy author the other day, like 45 books in 6 years or something. But her story was very
that I wrote as a teenager, all the angst of teenage years. I was writing into diaries and things like that. And then throughout my 20s, I let it go. And working in advertising and marketing, I just went to the side line. And then when I had my child in early 2008, I got back into it again. I started writing short stories, sent them off to my New Idea magazine and that kind of thing. And then I thought, I'm going to go and try and do a course. I did a local course at Northern Beaches Community College in one morning a week when he went to preschool. And I just thought to myself, do you know what? I'm going to just see if I can write a book. It sounds mad because I've not done a master's or a few courses. I'm just going to see if I can give it a go. So I started with my, probably when I was about 38, by my first book in the drawer book. And I think I just flogged out a bit too much. I spoke to Petronella, my governor, about this, and she said that we've worked on her first book for years and somebody had told her to stop.
Again. Yeah, I was the same. Yeah. I remember with my first book went on for years and in the end I just went, no, I've just got to stop and do something else.
So yeah, that was me. But I did get through to hard copy, which the Canberra at the time was called the Canberra Writers Centre, which is Marion now. It actually got me into their hard copy program when they picked 20 writers a year to mentor for a whole year. So I said to myself, okay, there was something in that. It might have not been right at the time, but it got me into that and it opened lots of doors. I sat down with lots of agents and publishers and got some really harsh feedback. So it was actually like a toughening up process. It was like pictures you book. And then I shelved back and started again in COVID and 2020 and started again writing from scratch again with Everything is Perfect, which is now Everything is Perfect. And I got my publishing contract through Writers Unleashed, which is the Southern Writers Festival.
Through the festival.
Yeah.
So you pitched at that festival?
Pitched at that festival, $50, and I saw that Beverly Cousins was there, who my publisher at Penguin, and I thought, my goodness, yeah, 5 minutes in front of Beverly. I was like, worth $50. Even if nothing happens, the advice she could give me in that time would, yeah. So I went down into the basement on that day and sat opposite her and pitched her. And I'd sent her probably 5 pages. And the first thing she said when I sat down, she goes, Max, I love it. And I was like, and we just sat there and I got all like tingly and I didn't know what to do and I got hot. But yeah, and then she said, please send me your whole manuscript and give me an email address. So that's where the process started for me. So that was in September 2022. But before that, I did get Di Blacklock to read it first and she was amazing. And I was so nervous in the month that she was reading it and then she just sent it back. She goes, there's something you missed, Matt. Okay, great.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So it was like a 14-year journey to this point.
Yeah.
But worth it. Yeah.
Great. I love them. It's so good, I think, for authors out there to, or people who have got those manuscripts and they're thinking about submitting that first book. I think it's really great for them to hear all the different ways in which you can approach it.
Yeah.
So, Jill, what was your story?
I was similar to Max in that I started writing a workplace intrigue kind of story about 15 years ago, and then it just hit roadblock and writer's block or whatever you want to call it, and just went into the top drawer because I found it really hard to write. And now looking back, I think it's having that creative space to be able to do it, because I was trying to do it while working full time. I had just had my first child. But I really want to write a book and I want to write it now. And I just couldn't figure it out in my head how the story was going to run. And I got to about, I think, 20,000 words and put it away. Actually, it'd be funny to go back and look at it now and see what it was like. But then High Heels and Low Blows came about because I had just been let go from a corporate job. And I also had a big birthday coming up and I thought that this is a moment, this is like the sliding doors moment. You either go and throw yourself back into a corporate job or you go after that goal that you've always wanted, which is to write this book. And also I had started talking to lots of women about their own workplace experiences. So I wanted it to be some kind of women workplace empowerment kind of theme. So yeah. So from there, I think it took me about 6 months to write my first draft. And I feel like I was really naive, actually, because I didn't even know the names of publishers. I just started Googling, who can I submit to? And in parallel with that process, I was walking my dog one day up at the local park, Tanya Park, and I met a woman walking her dog, and she said she was a publisher. And her name is Benita Merciardis, and she is the founder of Fair Play Publishing, which is a niche publisher. She's published a small amount of fiction, but her main focus is books about soccer, football, actually, if you're from the UK. So it's, you know, that where's your fit there? But actually, when we got talking, we had a lot in common, Benita and I. She is a FIFA whistleblower, and she's very like pro women's rights and pro diversity in the workplace and so on. And she being this FIFA whistleblower, she had this confidence about her that was about doing the right thing. And I think she liked that the theme in High Heels and Low Blows was about, you know, about women getting on top and men having their day. And so women standing up for what's right, whether it's in the workplace or personal relationship. Anyway, so cut a long story short, we sat down and had coffee because it was a bit inappropriate. That's it, at the dog park. You can never see a conversation probably up there. But then we had coffee and then I signed with her. So I was doing that. I was going out to publishers while talking to Benita, and then I went ahead with her, and it's been really good.
Fantastic. And just listening to all three stories, a couple of things that really strike me is, one, you started because you had this love and this passion, you wanted to get the writing done. But you kept writing and you were also making connection, you know, with other people in the industry, other writers, whether it be publishers, agents, whatever. But all the while, behind the scenes, you're writing away. And just, I think that's so important, that whole idea of, obviously we write in the hope that we're going to get published, but continuing to just get that writing done behind the scenes while that is or isn't happening out there is so important, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's going to book launches. Even I went to book launches and even without a contract, because I just wanted to start immersing myself in the community of writers in Australia and actually making some, and actually feeling like I'm supporting other writers at the time, which I think is really important down the track, really, to network, like you said.
Yeah, and you become part of that whole writing community. Yeah. And that's something that I've been talking about on the podcast the last couple of weeks, is if you're a writer, whether you're published or not, you are a writer. If you write, then you're a writer. And go out and make those connections and talk to people. And like you say, Max, go to book launches and things like that.
So, definitely.
Jill, we were talking before about the fact that this is a three point of view novel, three triple point of view. Was it always that way from the beginning for you? Is that like you wanted to portray three different characters, or did it evolve as you continued to write? How did that go?
No, I always wanted to write it from the different points, because I actually thought it was going to be really hard to just write it in the first person and to make it. I actually take my hat off to anyone that does that, because I think the multiple point, it allowed me to beef the story out. Personally, I think how would I make it into 100,000 words through the one viewpoint? But I also wanted to do it because the three women are so different and to reflect different viewpoints. But then they have similarities, of course, because they're all suffering at the hands of these toxic men. But they're all in different situations. So it's from a personal viewpoint. But there's also the professional viewpoint. So someone in the workplace, someone working in investment banking. I didn't want it to be all about that, because I realized that readers might not resonate with that environment, even though that's my background and I've worked in that industry for 20 years. I wanted to have multiple viewpoints to make it interesting to multiple readers, because I was always thinking about what the reader might like rather than, I suppose, just what I might like to read. So I introduced Lucy as a kind of character who, you know, because she has given up her career, she's very different to Bea Bloom, who is the career woman. Lucy is the complete opposite. She's at home, second guessing herself, doesn't know, really having a bit of an identity crisis, if you like, because she doesn't know who she is anymore. And then the third person, Rosie, was introduced because she sits in the middle of them. And I also wanted to throw in another kind of perspective there about how it readers an insight into how a PR person works and how they do their job in terms of going in and covering up things. It's a bit relevant now because we've got the hush money thing going on with Donald Trump at the moment. In the corporate world, there are lots of people that are called the fixers that just basically go in behind the scene and keep things out of the paper. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the corporate world. What interested me about and why I wanted to write about it, there's a lot of stuff that goes on that never really sees the light of day. So yeah, just wanted to introduce that into the story.
Yeah, really interesting. And what was your process in when you're writing that with the three different points of view? Did you write all of one story and then slot them all together? Or how did you approach that kind of triple point of view?
Quite a linear process in the sense that it was chapter by chapter. I think I'd written the beginning and then I knew how it would end, but it was very structured and very okay, alternating the viewpoints as the chapters went on it. And that's how the story built. It wasn't, oh, I'm just going to write what happens to be Bloom and then I'll insert Rosie later. It was always that it was things were happening at the same time and rolling along. And it was very structured in the sense that because I initially started writing and it was a bit all over the place and I was a bit frustrated with my whole writing process because I felt like it was a bit hobby. I was just trying to fit it in around stuff. But then the moment that I said, this is my job now, I'm not working, I don't have my corporate job at the moment, so I'm going to treat this like a proper job. I'm going to sit down at 9 a.m. and I'm not going to get up until 3 o'clock and then write again later, whatever it is. For me, unless I did that every day, it just wasn't, the word count wasn't going up.
So important to have that discipline, isn't it? Even though it's something that we love doing, it can also be excruciating at times. But yeah, having that discipline and getting that bum glue happening is really important, isn't it?
It's also having the time to be able to do it. I've actually just quit my job. I'm trying to write for an hour in the morning and then start a big, busy day. And it's just, you need, even if you're not spending all day writing, you need those hours to be thinking about it and letting the story develop in your head. So I just can't do both. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. I'll go you, Helen.
It's the moment, Helen.
Yes. From my stance, Helen, in terms of the writing process, you said you had heard that story. Did you actually meet the woman who was the inspiration for the story? And what other sort of research rabbit holes, I guess, you must have gone down quite a few in the writing of the book?
Yeah, yes, I did meet her. I met her through just one of the ballet moms at my daughter's ballet lesson, and she was a very close family friend of Lucy. And in fact, Lucy had completely transformed her life. She was a dance physio, so that's how she had met her. But by the time I met her, Lucy was very far advanced into dementia. So I went to her nursing home in North Tarramarra and just held her hand and she just kept squeezing my hand and it was just so lovely. And then I didn't get to see her again because of COVID and then she passed away. But she had also wanted her story to get out there all her life and she had done many writing courses. She spoke about 5 languages fluently and English wasn't her first language, but she had written her memoir and it was very much factual. This happened on this date, but that was my primary source document. So I stuck really closely to that because, of course, her family is still alive and I didn't want to subvert this story just for, you know, for fiction. So yeah, the facts are very closely based on that. But then, gosh, I did loads because I'm a journalist by training, as I said, so I did loads of research into Holocaust survivorship than what happened in the Holocaust, because the book's not an account of the Holocaust. It's a love story set against a backdrop of the Holocaust. So it was the human side of it that I wanted to understand. And the Jewish Museum were absolutely wonderful. I spent a lot of time there and I've spoken to a lot of Holocaust survivors and they all have very similar outlooks and messages and this amazing view of the world. I watched that and then every documentary about the Holocaust that I could, and there's plenty of stuff out about the Holocaust. It wasn't too hard to research.
Yeah, and I guess having that other character too who is doing the interviewing of your fictional Lucy would have allowed you then to play around a little bit more with the kind of more fictional elements. Like you said, you wanted to stick to Lucy's story, but I guess that gave you a little bit more freedom having the other character.
Yes, absolutely. And it allowed me to give the older Maya a voice and to talk about her outlook on the world. So that's why I put the young journalist in there. But then actually the journalist has her own character arc in the end as well, which and hers, there are shared themes between the two, the motherhood theme and how the importance of mothers and the importance of loving somebody else. So yeah, it just enabled me to play around with it rather than doing a straight account that a lot of Holocaust literature is. Yeah, I guess it's a bit different to a lot of Holocaust stories.
How about you, Max? Because I know that you drew on experiences from your own life, but also drew on a lot of experiences from women that you'd spoken to and your observations. How did you pull all that together in the writing process? Did it just come out naturally, or what was your process in doing it?
It was a bit weird. I know I've heard other authors say this, like a voice comes to you, and she's not my voice at all, because she just almost started speaking to me. It was very witchy-woo kind of thing. And I actually couldn't let her go until I'd finished, until I got it down. And I always know that when something's working for me in writing is when voice is really the most important thing for me, and I can't actually get going on anything until that voice comes. And before writing Cassie, I'd tried another few things, which I realized, I think, is my process. I go through a bit of like icky stuff. And then the minute that voice comes, I think, okay, I'm on now. I'm on the roll. So it was just, yeah, it was just listening to really to what she had to say. And like you said, Pam, the things that I'd learned about going away with girlfriends for the weekend and stories I've heard years of being at school with different parents and everything. I just soaked up all of that primary school life and funneled it out of her, really. There was a line in there, actually, it was about a... which is one of those things that when you're in a primary school, everything becomes so important, a little bit with, like, what that message is and have you got the right uniform and everything. And I did use a bit of truth in there with there was a proposal for a bottle shop, actually, to be opened off the school gate at one point. And there was like all the parents, like a massive kind of protest and all of this stuff because they didn't want the bottle shop off the school gate. And that actually was my, I just thought that was quite handy, actually. I suppose as a debut novel, I was drawing on what was around me, but it was also a lot of what was inside as well. And a lot of things that I was thinking about being in a relationship for so long. And all of that was just, yeah, instead of creating a story, I started off with my feelings about that, which I do. I journal stuff down every day and all that through character perspective. Really.
Oh, fantastic. Are you journaling about the novel writing process or just doing a vomit on the page of what's in your head?
It's everything. Things that are annoying me right now, things in the news, things in life, things to do with my kids, things to do with my parents. And then I will get back to things that are when I was a kid, or it's almost, I haven't got a therapist right now. I've just got this.
That's a book. I love it.
So, yeah, I start everything with that because that's just how I feel everything inside me. And I have listened to Chloe Higgins quite a lot. She was a mentor for a little bit. And she did say that most people actually don't feel anything from the neck down, and it's all in the head. So that's what I'm trying to get back, is working out what's going on past the head.
In
the body. And that's what I basically try and write down as well. But yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
It's therapy for me.
Yeah.
So I don't think I can ever stop.
I think we all have a bit of that going on with our writing. For sure.
Yeah, imagine.
Jill, what would you say would have been the main challenges for you in getting the story finished and into that kind of form that you were ready to submit?
Well, I think the main challenge was just the discipline and the... Because very early on, when you don't have a publisher on the scene and you don't know where it's going, I think the motivating factors for you in doing it, that's always a challenge, because it's some days I would just think, where's this going and who cares and what's driving me? And it all just seems so fanciful, doesn't it? Sometimes to just, is that to be, and maybe also a little bit selfish. I would just have moments where I just would battle with myself about what were my motivations, what were my intentions with the book. And that really comes back to having a lot of time by myself, because you are by yourself when you're writing. and you'd step away. And if you weren't having a great day and it wasn't all bouncing along nicely, you just think, what's the point? Because you're writing it for you. And then you were saying, Pam, that, yeah, a lot of writers, the end goal is that they do want to be published. I think I just didn't even really know. I just thought, I just want to finish it. But there were just some real highs and lows. There was quite some lows over the months of just keeping focused and what was my end goal. And I also felt really bad because I wasn't working for the first time in my life. I didn't have a financial income. Every month I'd been, whenever I started working back in London, always had an income, and to not, so that was a challenge for me as well. I had the enormous guilt about not contributing in any way financially, middle of a cost of living crisis, and I'm taking up decided that I'm going to fulfill this long held goal of mine. So yeah, I think all of the challenges, they were all up in my head.
How about for you, Helen?
Yeah.
What did you find were the biggest challenges?
So I think initially, the hardest thing was learning to write fiction where I'd been writing as a journalist for so long. It's a completely different form of writing. And it probably took me 2 drafts to actually realize I didn't have to report it. You're allowed to have the freedom to show. And I knew they told us in the writing course that you had to show. And I don't think I really understood it for a long time. And then when I got that, the floodgates opened, and that was wonderful. So not just about using figurative language, but just having that kind of cinematic view of what was going on. So that took me ages, but now I'm into it. It's coming. That's just how I write now. So I've learned that, thank goodness. And the other big issue I had was with structuring the novel, because the hardest, writing a Holocaust novel as a debut novel with a dual timeline was bitten off a bit more than I could chew with hindsight, but I didn't realize that. So my initial structure, I wanted to have them, the 2 characters going back to Poland and mirror the events, and it just didn't work at all. But then I decided to completely change it and just tell it chronologically, and that worked so much better. And when I got to that understanding, it all sorted itself out. Mm-hmm. So I'm writing the second one now, and I just feel like I'm just much more confident with both those things, like at the sentence level, but also at the structure level. I know what needs to come next, where I really didn't know the first one.
Yeah, it's a huge learning curve, isn't it, that first one? Yeah, so much to learn, and you just keep learning with each book. But how about for you, Max? Yeah. What did you find was the biggest challenge in getting it from that first idea to across the line?
Like Jill said, I completely get where she's coming from. Nobody is asking you to do this. Nobody's asking you to sit down every day and do this thing that might not be any outcome at all. And I think starting again was like a real struggle for me, because I put everything into that first book so long and nothing came out of it. But now I've looked back, it was that kind of needed to happen. I needed to be able to write that book to get to this point. And it's only when that happened you can actually realize it. At the time, if you're starting writing, and anybody out there who is writing their first book now or is having a go at doing it, the reality to say to yourself, this may not be it, and this may be a chance that I get to learn what to do. And at the time, it's horrible. You don't want to be told that.
Like, you're wasting your time, don't you? But it's not really, it's not wasted time, but the learning process,
They say no writing wasted. I can't remember that anyway. I will just hang on to that even now. So I think that was the biggest challenge for me, with moving from that to that, but to this. But now and it sounds weird, but now everything is perfectly written. There's points, I don't know if you were like this or anybody else, Helen or Jill, I actually can't believe I got to the end of a book, and sometimes I forget even writing it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, how did this happen? When did this happen? It's really strange to get to the end and then have this book thing in front of you. It's like having a baby, you know? I think that was the thing. I'm just so glad I carried on now, I would say, even that the roller coaster, like you were saying, is, and I think I've learned from you, Pam, as well recently, that just goes on. I think that's just accepting that is never going to change. Never going to change, even with the next book and the next book.
Yes, all part of the fun life, which it is. And Which leads me to my next question, Max. Let's stay with you for a minute. What have you, when you think back about that whole debut publishing experience, what have been the highlights for you?
Oh, my goodness. The first morning, after so long, thinking, am I actually going to see a book or something that I've written in a shop that people are going to buy, pick up and read my words that I've written in a cafe or on notes on my phone or when I went to kids at school. To actually see that in a bookshop, facing out on the new release table. And that morning, actually, that on my publication day, I had back-to-back radio interviews. So I was in here until lunchtime. And my sister was here from New Zealand and my husband, Darren, and they were out, like, scouring the shop for me, like, on the conman, just sending me pictures back from Birdland Books at Stockland.
What's been the highlight for you, Helen? What, when you think back about it, what are the things that really stand out as being amazing?
Like Max said, the first time you see your book on the shelves is just magic. And I'm used to seeing my byline in magazines and newspapers and things, but yeah, a whole book is something else. Actually, I met the managing director of Simon & Schuster at one of their functions, and he said to me, just cherish it. You'll never be a debut novelist again. Yeah. Just really enjoy it. And the other thing, like, I'm not a confident public speaker at all. So I was very nervous about the publicity, and I went and did a public speaking course in the end at NIDA, which was absolutely fantastic.
Great idea.
Yeah, yeah, it's so good. It was all about how you hold yourself physically, because I think that's what I was doing wrong. So I've done quite a lot of events and they've gone really well, and I've chatted away and I'm more proud of myself for being able to speak in front of a room of 70 people than I am writing a novel, I think. So that's been really wonderful. And then I suppose the other thing is that a lot of children of Holocaust survivors have come to my event. And I was really nervous about how they would take it because, you know, I am appropriating these awful, horrific experiences, the worst that humanity can do. And I've turned it into a novel for financial gain, really. I've had lots of feedback from people in the community that they really love the book. And for me, that's the absolute most important thing. I really don't care about anything else but the fact that people who have lived through it have endorsed it. Yeah, that's the best thing. Better than I ever could have hoped for.
Mm. Yeah, I can imagine it would have been quite nerve-wracking having the children of Holocaust survivors. What about Lucy's children? Did she have children?
No, she never had children. She didn't feel that she could mother them properly because of the trauma that she'd been through. And she had friends who had children, and the children just, all the guilt was invested on the children, and the children felt that they had to live extraordinary lives to make up for everything that their parents had lost. But she had three marriages, and her third marriage, her husband's still alive. He's 98 this week, or next week. And he had four children. So yes, they've supported the book. And I have given a copy of it to her husband, Peter, but I don't think he's read it. He looked and he said, oh, that's a lot of work. I don't think he's got any further than that, but he's supported me publishing because that's what Lucy always wanted it to be out there. So now it is.
Yeah, that'd be such a great feeling. How about for you, Jill? What have been the highlights in having your book published?
The same as Max and Helen, really. Yes, seeing it in its hard copy versions is amazing. But also, as Helen said, sometimes it's the feedback as well that you get in the emotions that maybe it evoked for some readers. And for me, when I was thinking about a target audience, really, it was that corporate woman that might have had a bit of a rough trot. And I've had women just say, oh, and it's not satisfying because it's unfortunate that they've had a poor experience in the workplace. But the fact that the words on the page had made them feel seen was one of the ways someone described it to me. The way that it validated, like, how she had been made to feel in her role. And I wrote something, I had an interview in the Australian Financial Review, and actually after that was the weekend the book came out, I had a panting jogger run towards me, and it was one of the school moms, and she said, oh, I read your interview. It just resonates so much with me. Women, we're either still wearing Teflon to go into the office sometimes, or some of us are just stepping away because it is still really hard. And I think for people that aren't in that industry sometimes think it's 2024, hasn't the world moved on? And yet, as in some areas, but it really hasn't in others. In the UK at the moment, there's this whole sexism in the city inquiry looking at the increase in harassment, bullying and discrimination in the financial services sector. And I started my career in London in 1997, and to hear that it's still, if not just as bad, if not worse, it really depressing to me, because it's like we're trying to keep more women in the workplace, and yet these barriers that they face all the time, either from the hands of poor toxic men that are power hungry and don't behave properly, that still really, really angers me. Anyway, so to have the feedback is really nice, because you sometimes think, oh yeah, it's all up in my head. But one of the other really lovely things is that it has opened up this whole new network for me, because you have friends throughout life, you move into groups where when it's about the schools or it's about work, and then to have this whole new group of other authors and to talk to authors, and also in a very welcoming circle, like they're all so positive and supportive. It's really lovely, because I think back to high heels and low blows, and sometimes having lived through a very cutthroat environment, and then to be so welcomed in this environment, it's just, that's been really lovely. And I'm going to an author talk tonight for Amy Hutton, and I booked that on my own. I'm just going by myself, but I'm sure that there will be people there that I know. And it's not like walking into a corporate event where I don't know anyone and I think, oh, who's going to be here? The atmosphere is very different. Yeah.
I love going to those things. I've turned up to life by myself, and you actually get there and then you realise that three people. It's been great.
And I think we've been talking about everybody going through that writing process and going through the experience of publication, and whether you have actually been published yet or not. I think you're in a room with, obviously there's readers there too if it's a book launch, but when there's a whole bunch of other writers around, everybody's had that shared experience of, we know the ups and downs of what it's like to write a book and to get it out there and to then grapple with the next one. And so I think that kind of is a bit of a glue too for everybody in that writing community.
I was just going to say, I found the more established authors particularly have been really generous with their advice and their time, which is, I haven't seen in, certainly not the case in journalism. It's much more cutthroat. But I just feel like in the world of being an author, the more support you can give each other, the better it is for the industry, which has been absolutely unexpected and really lovely.
Yeah. Jill?
No, what I was going to say was everyone's so supportive and willing to give advice, but also it's really good to hear that everyone's going through the same stuff. Varying degrees. Sometimes I sit at home and think, oh, is it just me that feels like this? Or is it, because actually the one thing that overwhelms me as well is social media, because I actually wasn't on any.
Because that was my next question. So keep going with that.
I was on LinkedIn, and which is just for obviously professional, and you don't really post anything too fluffy on there. So I haven't really minded that. But my first post on Instagram was me signing my contract, because I thought, oh, I've got to step out of the shadows now. I've actually always quite liked looking at other people, but then I don't really like posting about myself. So that was another aspect that, you know, to put yourself out there. But I remember I didn't even know what post. So I'd look at other authors and I copied someone's. It was Kirsty Jaggers. We were both talking at the Man and Writers Festival, and I sent her a DM and I said, oh, I'm just copying the template. And she said, oh yeah, don't worry, we all do that. We're all just thinking, pinching ideas, because I just didn't know what to post, because I thought, well, is anyone interested in this? Yeah, so that side of things is quite tricky. It always felt to me quite narcissistic, the personally, the social media. But I'm getting the hang of it a little bit now. I'm just trying to align it a lot with the book rather than as me. And that something gives me a bit more comfort.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to approach it. How about you, Max? How have you found the whole kind of social media and promotion side of thing?
It was quite full on, isn't it? Early. And actually, the leading up was the biggest thing. I think it was like the week beforehand, and I was trying to think of interesting stuff to put on there. And my dad actually said to me, guess what? You were posting a lot about your book.
Like, yeah, Dad, that's the point. And then, and afterwards now, I suppose, like Jill, I have got a lot more
used to it. I actually do use my dog quite a lot because I find that a really good kind of, so it's not just my faith and me, there's something else there that kind of shows what kind of life that I like to live. So I do use Snoop quite a lot, apart from when she barks. But yeah, I found that really helpful. And then also, yeah, like also putting other books on there that I've loved or like events that I've been to. And then always, I've been trying to like ask questions of people who to have some kind of interest. There's something else going on.
Yeah, a bit interactive sort of thing.
Yeah, a bit interactive. My friend Alice calls it a character pop. If you probably don't know the lingo, something that's different to you on your social media, this shows a bit more of your personality, I think. So I've been trying to do that and then to get some interest that moves on so it can move on through me as a person then into out of the book kind of world.
Yeah. And I think readers are interested in, I guess you've got to decide how much of your life you want to put out there on social media.
Team boy, they're like, I can't even put a shadow of them on there. Not even a hand. Which I totally understand.
So Helen, you said you did the public speaking course, which has been really helpful. How have you navigated the rest of the kind of social media and promotion side of things?
So again, I've found it really difficult. And I think because I come from a journalism background, because most journalists really should not be the story. That's what you're always told. You're reporting other people's stories. So I hate self-promotion in any part of my life. I'm quite shy. But I quite like the social media. I'm learning it. I don't think I'm doing a great job, but I am posting regularly, which is more than I did before. I think the hardest thing for me has been not really knowing the industry or how to market myself and knowing what to do next. I'm 3 months in and the really busy time is over now and they've all moved on to the next books that have come out now. What should I be doing? Should I be still trying to do events? Should I still be trying to get the book out there, or will people just all be really sick of me? I think it's more a mental issue than a technical one. So yeah, nobody teaches you this stuff. Publishers and the agents move on to the next thing and you're left there. So I think having the author group has been absolutely critical, and just taking people's advice and, you know, to be able to text Max or somebody else and say, how do you do that? How can I do it? Just getting advice from other people has been fantastic.
I love that group. Like on Friday night, I was like on the sofa, glass of wine. Oh, I know who I can tell. Nebby crew, how I'm feeling. I miss my...
So tell us a bit about the debut crew.
Yeah, Lisa Kenway, whose book is about to come out in August, set it up. I think it's been going for a couple of years. I think it did come out of the first time podcast originally with Kate Milton-Hall and Claire. Okay. I think they started it and then it rolled on Facebook. So just a community of debut authors who are coming out in the year that you come out on Facebook. So it was like sharing, if we see each other's book in the airport or we see it in a bookshop, we'll take a quick picture and post it on there, or we'll put our launch information in there, or just things that have worked, but I think that haven't worked. To do, like you said, with social media, and just to do with, it's a lot of how, like, maybe I'm somebody that has overshared a lot of how I'm feeling. Is anybody else feeling like this? Well, this awesome thing happened today, I can't believe it. Every kind of part of the spectrum is on there, and it's been great. And a real community, people come to Sydney, or somebody goes to Melbourne, or Amber, or Adelaide, or wherever the person is meeting up. And I mean, you meet them in real life, it's actually great. Actually, feel like you know each other already. It's actually been a really important part of the whole journey this year.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. I've had authors before it started, went, love that.
Yeah. I think it's great to have that support. Really important. So what would you say, Max, would be, there's probably a lot, but if you could narrow it down to one main piece of advice that you would give to authors who are either submitting for their first book to a publisher or agent or going through that debut process. Can you think of something that, you know, would have been really helpful for you to know?
Yes. I think before you're submitting, I had to take the emotion out of it, because I was actually finding early on the process quite exhausting and quite personal. And I've learned since then that it's not anything to do with you or the standard of your writing. It is all to do with the business of publishing and where they are right now, what they can take on and what they can't. So to take that personal feeling out of it, which I think I've heard a lot of people do this, if they just start a spreadsheet. So if I was submitting or just starting to submit now, I would definitely do that again. I would set up, which I didn't do for the first few with my first book. I just sent them out thinking, and then I learned that and I got the spreadsheet and put the publisher's name and the tick or the cross. And then all I said to myself was, I just need a tick. That's one tick. I just need one tick. And I just had that going through my head. And then you have the tick. So that's to do before you get published. That would be my biggest piece of advice, to just keep going. As a debut for your first book coming out, I would say it goes so quickly. It is just a blink and it's just 4 months later and it's a whirlwind of stuff, and then you've gone and you're just like, oh, this is great. This is amazing that this happened. But it's so quick. It's almost every single day to hang on to that time, I would say. I just really take it in, even going camping in the bookshop, but everything before it's on the shelf, before it's not in there anymore. So I would say just really take a moment to just appreciate what you've done, the hard work you've put in to get to that point, and just be really proud of yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great advice. How about you, Jill? What bits of advice would you give to kind of people at both of those points?
So firstly, maybe try and be patient once you've finished it, because I think for me, I got really anxious about that. I'd finished this product and I actually probably should have gone back now when I think about it and edited it and done another edit and another edit. Instead, I just thought, oh, it's done, it's finished. But I realised that what I'd sent out, first couple of people that I'd sent it to, it really wasn't. And that's a bit embarrassing, because you get that one opportunity. And every time then I went back, because you can just keep editing forever and ever, can't you? Eventually, that's it. Okay. But I do think that there were some, I probably should have, given that I'd spent 6 months writing something, which probably doesn't sound too long in the scheme of things, I probably should have spent another two finessing rather than then getting impatient about what was next. And then the other thing is just keep pushing as well. So when you have got it finished, because I think Helen was saying, the publisher then moves on to the next one. And when you're in that no person's land, that's a bit weird, because the buzz has gone out of the whole debut and it's time's passed and you're thinking, how long do I keep pushing? And I suppose it just keep pushing until no one else wants to hear about it. Okay. Just keep hustling and seeing if there's other opportunities. For me as well, because I'm with a niche publisher, I wrote a couple of opinion pieces as well. And one of them landed finally in the Sunday Life magazine on the weekend.
Fantastic. Well done.
And that was all about workplace heartbreak. So similarities between a professional breakup and a personal breakup and the cheese that you go through. But also, so I think thinking creatively about how you can position yourself to get the book out, because it might not be just a write-up or a review. There might be other ways to get your voice out there that lead back to the book.
Yeah, I think that's so important, because like you say, it has a certain shelf life in bookstores and even online. They're always available online, but in terms of being a debut, being the book that's out there at the moment. But if you can find those other ways, and your publisher tends to move on to the next author or whatever. So it's really up to us to keep word out there about the book, isn't it? And to find new ways to actually promote it and let people know about it.
Yeah, I went and spoke at a Commonwealth Bank women's event recently, which wasn't something I thought about. And then when I went to it, I thought, yeah, this is perfect, because I was thinking more about the bookshop event. Readers coming there, and that's because that's what I see. Everyone's going doing books in bars. I'm looking at what other people are doing. And then it was actually my husband mentioned that to me and said, Women in Banking and Finance, which is a not-for-profit forum, why don't you try and talk at that event? So just thinking a bit more about, not just about the reader being in the bookstore, where else I might target to think about it commercially.
Well, that's a great idea. How about you, Helen? What bits of advice would you have for people either submitting or and also at the point of having had that first book out?
So I know a lot of writers who are just, yeah, not finishing their books. They're wanting the book to be absolutely perfect. So while I think Jill's absolutely right, you don't want to send it in undercooked, I also think I didn't realise until I was published how much more work you're going to do on it after it's picked up. So it's certainly got to be at a stage that you're happy to submit it. But if you're the sort of person that is going to mind if they just completely cut out a character or change the end or change the structure, then you've got to be prepared for that. And if you can't do it, then maybe do something just right for you. So the key thing is to keep writing, get it finished, and then be ready for it to be changed. And then I think once it's published, the main thing is to manage your expectations. So I think loads of debut authors think this is going to be the next, I don't know, Hayley Scrivener or Leanne Moriarty or something. I think we all think that. And then I think disappointment is a real issue for a lot of debut authors. And I think be realistic. It's an absolutely amazing achievement to have a book picked up and published. And I don't think we celebrate that enough, rather than obsessing about sales, which of course we all do, but just really enjoy the fact that you wrote a book. It's amazing. So that I wish I had somebody who told me that before I'd been through this. So I'm really just trying to be happy now that I've got a book out there and get back into the writing process.
Fantastic. And what's next for you, Helen? You're working on another book now.
I am. So I got a 2-book deal with Simon & Schuster. I was very lucky. And I think the wisdom is that the second one should be along the same lines of the first, because your readers will want more of the same. So it's actually very loosely based on my family's story. We always thought at the turn of the last century that my family came from Russia, but it was actually Ukraine, which I found out by getting my dad an ancestry.com genetic test. We found all these relatives in America that we didn't know we had, and who knew where the family was originally from. But yeah, so I have Ukrainian ancestry, so I'm imagining the story of how my family escaped from Ukraine to London in 1904.
Wow, fantastic. And you've got all that experience from the first one to push you forward with the new one.
I hope so. It's going more slowly than I had hoped, but anyway, I know from the first one that I will get there. Just at the moment, I'm at the bottom of the mountain. By the time you've gone for a few months, you can see the sun.
Yeah, true. How about you, Jill? You working on another one?
I am. I'm at the bottom of the mountain as well. How long is it going to take me? I just don't know is the answer with this one, because I am working. I've got a part-time corporate job, whereas I wasn't working with the first one. And so, yeah, it's a workplace intrigue. It's very gender. It's about gender in the workplace and gender games, if you like. So gender games that we play in our personal relationship and in the workplace. And I think Helen was saying, I'll try and make that my focus area. We'll be writing about women's issues with work through the relationships that they have with people. And it's a three women theme again. So I've got three very different women, and it's tackling some difficult material, but I'm trying to do it in a way, because I never want these things to be too depressing, if you like. A little bit of a comedic angle as well to lighten the mood, so it can take you through different emotions. But we'll see. It might take me another 6 months, but I don't know. Helen, what's your timing? Do you get yourself, or does Simon & Schuster give you one?
I'm contractually obliged to send it in March. My contract says it needs to be, the first draft needs to be sent to them in March, so that's what I'm hoping for.
Good to have a deadline.
Yeah.
Even if you miss it. How about you, Max? Where are you at with your next one?
Yeah, I realised my process is writing something and then letting it go. Right, start again. I mean, so recently dawned on me that's actually what I do. So last year I was really trying to get them a lot of words down while I was waiting for everything to be published. And I got to the beginning of this year and looked at it and went, do you know what? No, just something wasn't firing me. Something has to really fire me up to get into the story. And it was like, no, okay, that's what I did last time. Let's start again. So I am, yeah, I'm into something now. I think the main theme of this is anger, especially middle age anger. I'm just honing in on the middle aged woman right now because I'm that age. And the stuff that's coming out, but she's very angry. She's got the stuff in her past she's never dealt with, and the stuff that's going on in the world that's just fueling her up. And I just thought, okay, I want to write a female falling down kind of thing with Michael Douglas. She's in a similar Sydney community, and yeah, it might all come bubbling out. I don't know. We talk about that whole Boston Panther thing.
Yeah.
I'm with her on that ride as well. I don't know what is going to happen. I do have a piece of paper next to my bed now, which I'm cleaning my teeth and I'll get into bed. Then I'll sit up and I'll just write something. So I've got like pages, papers all over the side of my paper. But I think things are, yeah.
Are you contracted with this format?
No, I'm not. No. Which fits with me quite a lot. My kind of personality. I'm like Helen's a trained journalist, she's used to deadlines, and it would have thrown me all off. And she's quite happy with that, really, to be able to get into the story without any pressure right now. But I will put a deadline on at the end of the year for my first draft, is what I'm saying to myself. So, yeah. Celebrating pop bubbles and I've turned
to it. Nice. It's been so lovely chatting to you all.
I just want to say this was really great doing something like this and a panel kind of chat. It's been really great to Jill and Helen's experience the same thing as well. So yeah, thank you everybody.
No problem.
Honestly, from my perspective, these opportunities are amazing. I think to have a platform to be able to talk about the book, every single opportunity is for me is gold dust. When I first started talking about it, like Helen, it's a bit nerve-wracking. Like I've always worked other side where I put people out to talk in the media. It's really weird. You know, go on, you've got to do an interview and this is what you need to say. It's funny because I was talking to our chief columnist at work about this and he said, you'd be fine at it. And I said, no, because I'm always the one, I've always just been behind the scenes. And I think any opportunity to talk about it gets you better at doing it. So hopefully you learn and you don't overthink it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's also... So it's also really nice to for your listenership who are writing, because there isn't much support for debut authors,
yeah,
I don't think.
I agree.
You know, it's just assumed that you know what to do. And you have no idea how this industry works. So, thank you.
No worries. Thanks. I think another great thing to say to anybody out there who is listening and maybe struggling with anything like that, if you are in those early stages, is I'm pretty sure you girls would all feel the same, but I'm always happy for people to DM me or email or just contact if you have a question or pop it onto one of the Facebook groups or something. Everybody's really happy to help. Like we were saying, the Australian writing community is so supportive, and don't be afraid to reach out to people, I think, is important to know.
Yeah, definitely.
I'll let you get on with your day. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And I'll see you, I'm sure, definitely. At the launch somewhere soon.
Thanks for listening to Writes for Women. I hope you've enjoyed my chat with this week's guest. If you did, I'd love it if you could add a quick rating or review wherever you get your podcasts so others can more easily find the episodes. Don't forget to check out the backlist on the Writes for Women website. So much great writing advice in the library there. And you can also find the transcript of today's chat on the website too. You can find details on the website on how to support the podcast through Patreon. And you can connect with me through the website at writesforwomen.com, on Instagram and Twitter at W4WPodcast, the Facebook page Writes for Women, or find me and my writing at pamelacook.com.au. Thanks for listening, have a great week, and remember, every word you write, you're one word closer to typing the end.